Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
Hey, it's that time again. One of the missions that we support is a regular part of our giving here at the Vineyard is a new generation. And we'd like to ask you every year at Mother's Day, we make a habit of taking these baby bottles and putting them out. You can grab one of those baby bottles. Our goal is that you would fill that between now and Father's Day, that you'd have it back to us by Father's Day as we're celebrating what they're doing in their ministry, but also it's our opportunity. It's their largest fundraiser of the year and a chance for us to help them, to help young families in our community. So want to encourage you, if you would, we've got the baby bottles out there, and if you would get those and fill them up. The only thing we do ask is if you take a baby bottle, would you please make sure and that bottle gets returned? It's part of their accounting system. And so whenever those bottles go out, we'd like to get it back either with a nice big fat check or your coins or your dollar bills or whatever else you would like to put in there to bless them. But we do ask that you make sure and get those bottles back to us by Father's Day. You're welcome to bring it back, of course, sooner than that as well. All right. Well, it is Cinco de Mayo. You know what that means, don't you? Tacos, you know, I mean, like, you know, we were just talking last night, actually, you know, Cinco de Mayo, it's kind of funny, when I was a missionary in Mexico, you know, nobody celebrated Cinco de Mayo. It's just, it's one of those Mexican holidays that only Americans celebrate, unless you go to a tourist donate, you know, location, you know, and then it's all about the tequila anyhow, but anyhow, you know, so tacos, everybody have some tacos and celebrate. Just like on St. Paddy's Day, everybody becomes Irish. On Cinco de Mayo, everybody's Mexican. All right. So we're going to have a good time this morning. We're going to jump into Esther chapter 2 this morning, continuing our series on the epic life, living an epic life. And as you're turning to Esther chapter 2, you know, many of us dream of doing something special in life. We live in a culture and a society that really values rock stars. People want to be a somebody. And so there's this sense within us. In fact, many studies that have been done on our society indicate that most people have some innate sense that they're going to be somebody someday, that something amazing is going to happen in their life, and that they are going to, you know, be that rock star. They're going to be the superstar in some moment. And yet, whenever they continue to interview those persons, what they find is that most people have no earthly idea why or how. They just know that they're special and that somebody else is going to notice how special they are. And the truth is that most of us dream of doing that right thing in the right moment, that we will say or do the right thing to win the day, that we will win the game, or that we will defeat the bully. Many of us have aspirations that somehow we'll be given the opportunity to grab the mic, jump up on stage, and sing just the right song at the right moment, and everybody will applaud, or we'll have that perfect karate move to deal with the person, you know, who is causing problems, the bad guy, or we're going to close that great big deal that makes us a fortune, although we have nothing to sell. But we have a society that just is certain that that's going to happen to us. Now, a dear friend of mine, when I was a youth pastor many years ago, a dear friend of mine, Miriam, was just such a person. She was bigger than life, and all the young boys were convinced, of course, that she was going to be a star because she was a pretty girl, and she was a whole lot of fun to be around. But, you know, the thing was about Miriam is that Miriam always felt like she was going to be somebody spectacular, someone amazing. And the thing is that Miriam actually did grow up to be an amazing person, a spirit-filled missionary who did amazing work. In her growing up as a teen in my youth group, you know, she had no aspirations of being a missionary or anything like that. She grew up in a missionary family, but she was going to be a rock star or somebody important. She grew up to be a missionary, and her mission field was that she felt called to go to South Africa and take care of little babies who were dying of AIDS. So her ministry when she went to South Africa was that she would go and they would give her these young babies who had but just weeks or months to live. And she would hold them every day and comfort them and change them and love them and eventually let them die in her arms. Miriam never dreamed that that was how she was going to be a real star. Along the way, she met her husband there while she was working in South Africa as a missionary, and he was Mr. South Africa, the bodybuilder. He was an amazing bodybuilder. He was a very dynamic individual, but as he got to know Miriam and Jesus began to touch his heart, the emphasis went from building a whole chain of gyms, which he still has, but the emphasis went from doing that to wanting to serve Jesus alongside of her and to take care of these children, and so it became their common practice that they took on a home full of these children, and they were together holding those AIDS babies as they spent their few precious days of life in the arms of a mom and dad who would care for them and love them until they left this earth. In that process, one of the things that they also did was they found out that there were a lot of young people who had been orphaned because of the AIDS epidemic there in South Africa, and so one of the things they did also was they adopted two beautiful young ladies and brought them into their home and raised them to know the Lord, and that they are serving the Lord today as young adults. As she continued to work in ministry in her adopted country, she continued to find new ways to be God's star in a way she never anticipated. You know, in South Africa, it is not uncommon in middle-class neighborhoods to be robbed at gunpoint by those who were poor. The rich are well guarded, but the middle class are not, and yet they have much of what the poor do not have, and so often it's taken from them at gunpoint. Miriam often heard stories about these things and concerned herself with them, but was always praying that she would know what to do when that moment came, if it came. She met great women of faith in her community who had led robbers to Christ, who had literally, like in the moment, guns blazing in their face, they were standing there terrified, and they were able to share Christ with their assailants and lead them to Jesus. Others she knew had, in the moment, disarmed their invaders and captured them and been able to handle the situation. And so she believed that as she continued to pray, that she would know the right thing to do, be strong in the moment, and be able to handle herself. Until a few weeks ago, when that moment fell upon her, and all she could remember was the neighbors who didn't make it, those who had been killed in moments like that. She couldn't think of anything clever to say. Couldn't remember the Bible verses that she had practiced in the mirror to say in that moment. Instead, her mind went blank. She felt helpless. She wanted to be the hero, and instead she felt like she was the victim. The good news is they escaped with their lives. Her parents were there visiting. They're missionaries in Ethiopia. He is the only OB-GYN for nearly 6 million women, regularly saves lives. His parents were there also. Her husband had just recently injured himself, and so he was incapacitated in the middle of all of this, and she was watching these events unfold. They held a gun to her husband. They smashed her mother-in-law over the head with one of their guns, and her head was bleeding. Their family was curled under the table, and she thought sure in that moment that her children were going to watch their father murdered. She couldn't think of a thing. She couldn't remember where the panic button was, couldn't remember what to do. And between sobs, she took all of her jewelry off, some of it heirloom, family heirlooms, and gave it to them, hoping that they would just leave them all alive. It wasn't the superhero moment she wanted. She wanted it to be something amazing. And yet, can I tell you what a superhero Miriam really was? She rescued her parents, who were able to go back and take care of family members and to go back and work as a missionary doctor in Ethiopia. If she hadn't done that, he might have been killed. In that moment that she was giving away her jewelry, see, she was holding on to people instead of things. And what Miriam didn't realize is that she was quite the hero in the moment. And she said, you know, that even though it didn't go down the way she thought it would, the way she had rehearsed it in her mind, the way that she had planned for it to do, she realized that in that moment that it was that voice of God that she was listening to, in that terrible moment that got her through her time of crisis. You see, she's a real hero because she'll still be able to hold children who are dying of AIDS. And those two young women that she raised up, that they're still continuing in ministry. And her family's safe. Miriam was a hero that day. It was nothing like she ever imagined. You know, one of the things that I have learned, that others have learned over and over again, is that when it comes to the difficult moments in life and you're wondering how you will respond and you wonder what you will do, can I just tell you that if you will not listen to the voice of God and follow His lead in the dull and mundane moments of life, you will not be able to hear His voice in time of crisis. But if you will listen to His voice in the dull and mundane moments, even when you are torn apart in your heart and in your mind and you don't know what to do, you will still hear the voice of God and be able to obey it. But you will not be able to discern His voice in the noise if you will not learn to discern it in the quiet. How do we live epic lives? How do we experience the presence of God? Let's take a look in the life of Esther. Esther chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please follow along in the translation you have. That one in your lap is my favorite because you're reading it. Esther chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, and we read, "And after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus," or Xerxes, "had been abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, well, let virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, and who's in charge of the women, and let there be cosmetics given them, and the young women who pleases the king will be queen instead of Vashti." And this pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away when Jehoiakim, king of Judah, was carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure, and she was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won the king's favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics and portions of food, and with seven young chosen women from the king's palace. and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made it known who her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day, Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now, when the time came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since there was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young women went in and to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shahasag, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the time came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her in as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charged the women, advised her. Now Esther, who was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her, when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave her a great feast for all of his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred of her people. And as Mordecai commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. And in those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresa, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. And when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were brought and hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. Now, once again, just like last week, there's no mention of God. I mean, that's why people tend to avoid this book quite often in preaching. It's great for Bible studies usually, but we don't usually preach out of it because it doesn't specifically mention God, but God is ever present. And God being present specifically in this situation, it's biblical events that are unfolding that will affect the history of the Jewish people and ultimately the history of all the people in the world, the hope of Messiah. So even in silence, even when his name isn't mentioned, here's the thing, God is still central to the topic, even when we don't think so. It's an important lesson for you and I to know that even when God isn't mentioned, that he is still very much in our circumstances. Last week I mentioned that King Ahasuerus is the that's the Hebrew name for Xerxes. And I mentioned, you know, the movie 300. If you've ever seen the movie 300, there is the battle between the warriors fighting off the Medo-Persians. And, you know, the story is how they clamped down on the 300 men and destroyed them. And there's this horrid king, you know, Xerxes. And there he is in all of his glory. He is a beast of a man, physically imposing, but also he's vile. In fact, you don't even hear the full story when you watch the movie 300. See, part of his way of dealing with things, when he would come to a people and tell them to surrender, if they wouldn't surrender, he would wage war with them, but he would draw off numerous amounts of his troops and send them around the other side by water or however else, over land or sea, whatever was necessary to get to where all the people who were doing battle over here had come from over here. And he would wipe out their families, their women and their children and their old men, and devastate them for them daring to stand against the mighty Xerxes. He was one of the vilest and cruelest rulers in all of history. That's who Queen Esther is married to. That's the one who's being tender and so appreciative of her that he's giving everybody a tax break in all the provinces, even back to Jerusalem and to Babylon, the places that he's conquered. This vile man, this man who was known for his cruelty, and yet his tenderness to Esther. And yet, the man who, when he realized that he had banished Queen Vashti, who he cared for very deeply, could no longer see her, was hurt within his heart. That's the Xerxes that we're talking about. Obviously, in this situation, Hadassah, Esther is not known as being a Hebrew, as being a Jew. It's worked because the Jews, those who hate the Jews, have no idea that she's Jewish. And yet we will find out shortly that there are a lot of people who were against the Jews, who persecuted them. Instead, in that moment, she's selected for her beauty among all of the Medo-Persian women of her day. And part of why she is so selected is because of her many other qualities she had in addition to her looks. She is not only beautiful, she is virtuous, a virgin, well-mannered and well-spoken, so that her outward beauty is matched by her inward beauty and her charm. But before we're told of her beauty, before we're told of her charms, we're reminded from where she came and how she came into this land because of war and because of hardship. First, the people were carried off to Babylon in 605 by Nebuchadnezzar, and her family was among those, along with the family of Daniel, who were carried off into another land so that they could not keep their land or be able to rise up against Babylon ever again. Now, 66 years later, King Cyrus II has taken those same people captive again from Babylon and dragged them to the citadel of Susa so that they will no longer be a thorn in his side. They are a people who are hated, a people who are not trusted. And here she is in the middle of this situation. And consider that it is in this second situation, when the Medes and the Persians have overrun Babylon and taken them away, is how that she now has become an orphan. Her family wasn't influential. It wasn't royal. And she's now an orphan at the very hands of the people she's now called to serve as queen. Can you imagine the emotional turmoil and the tension that could be in that for her? Her elevation to queen was as surprising to her and to everyone around her as it possibly could be. And now in this situation, she's faced with two equally opposite conclusions. Here in the midst of her beauty, her social skill, her ability to seduce the king, what would it be used for? It would have been easy for her to say, no, I will never serve this king. I hate this man. His father is the one who caused the death of my parents. His people like him that destroyed my nation and my people. I hate those people. I'll never serve you. She could have. And who could blame her? She could have used her great opportunity as a chance to seduce the king and to murder him in his sleep or something like that. I mean, she could have been about vengeance and getting equal. Have you ever considered that the God who created you and gave you the abilities that he gave you, the skills that he has given you to do something grand that he has planned for you, even in the most difficult of circumstances, even in a situation that you wouldn't want to be in? Paul says in Ephesians 2:10, for we are his workmanship. We were crafted by him, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. God created Esther with a full knowledge of the challenges before her, just as God created you on purpose and with a plan. And the truth is, do you know no one, not even kings, can keep you from walking in the plans that God has for you except you? So Esther had a choice. She could be bitter about her hardships. She could be bitter about being raised by her cousin. Or she could recognize the hand of God over her life, even in the midst of tragedy, hardship, and difficulty. What an amazing man she was raised by. One who would keep his head even in the most difficult of situations. One who would counsel her in such a way that she knew that even there in the household of the king, that she could trust him, that she could believe in his decisions, that she knew that he knew the Lord and he had taught her to walk with the Lord. So even though we don't see the name of the Lord specifically mentioned as of yet, it will be in his counsel, his godly counsel that he will give her, that the nation, the people of Jews would be protected, that a temple would be rebuilt, the people of God would go on to be the hope of the world. So Esther trusted God, and she trusted her cousin. He'd been faithful in raising her, taught her the ways of the Lord. But in this moment, she is thrust into an unbelievable situation. What do you do when you're in unbelievable situations? This is where God is unfolding his plan to us. Stage one, to build up the name of a guard named Mordecai and Queen Esther. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, but she's the queen. What does it matter? I mean, why does God have to build up her name? Can I just remind you that last week in chapter 1, we saw what happened to Queen Vashti, who was beautiful, talented, was a great host and great servant and everything else. But the moment that she didn't do or say the things that exactly pleased him, he listened to his buddies, his best friends, the guys who were around him, single, dumb guys that didn't know anything about being married, and he listened to them even to the point of banishing her forever. It's not enough to be the queen. That doesn't guarantee you influence. It's not enough to be charming, and it's not enough to be well-spoken. Queen Vashti was all of those things. Even loved by this hateful, cruel man who was king. And yet banished in a moment. Because his buddy said, get rid of her. She is going to be presented with a moment where she is going to have to speak against one of the king's buddies. But right now, God is setting the stage so that Esther can build credibility, and so can Mordecai, so they would know that the words that come to Esther from Mordecai are trustworthy words. They don't know that they're related. They don't know the connection between them. All they know is that Mordecai is a faithful servant of the king, and Queen Esther, the one who had the opportunity to betray him from the inside, faithfully serves her husband and her king. Not so she can get even, but so that the work of God might be seen through her. The plans for nations and for the hope of the world might be realized through her. Could anybody blame Esther for being bitter? Could anyone blame Esther if she had said no to this opportunity? If she had said, no, I won't do these things. If she had cried out, why do you want me? I'm a Jew. If she complained, if she was working counter to the things that the king needed, if she had even allowed him to be set up, could anyone blame her? But she was looking for a direction from the Lord. And she was trusting the counsel of the godly man who had raised her. And so God sets it up to make Mordecai the trusted advisor to the king, one who would look out for the king's well-being. You see, King Ahasuerus, Xerxes, isn't a good guy. But God is going to use him to defend the Jewish people. Xerxes isn't a good guy, but God's going to use him to rebuild the temple of God in Jerusalem. King Xerxes isn't a good guy, but God will use him to restore the people of Israel back to their homeland. You see, here's the thing. As creator of the universe, there is no question whether or not God will use you. The only question is how. The Apostle Paul writes and says in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 20 through 21, "Now in a great house there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honorable use, some for dishonorable use. Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy, useful to the master of the house, and ready for every good work." You see, when you think back to those times, I mean, every vessel had a purpose in the house, doesn't it? Gold vessels are what you drink the wine from. And there are other vessels where you relieve the wine into. There are noble vessels where you prepare the food and serve the food. There are ignoble vessels where you scrape the food off and feed the cattle and the pigs. There are noble vessels where you put your greatest treasures. There are ignoble vessels where you put your trash. In every house, there are noble vessels and ignoble vessels, but all of them will be used by the Master. Can I just help us all to get that deeply ingrained in our hearts? The question isn't whether or not God will use you. God raises up men like Xerxes, who was much more vile than the people of God he chastened by the power of Medo-Persia, who was more vile than Nebuchadnezzar, who he'd used to chasten the people of God. Because, see, God is interested in purifying vessels for noble purposes, and so sometimes God will use that which is ignoble to help purify that which is noble. Sometimes circumstances and events will come into your life, and you will think, how can God use that? And the answer is that he is provoking us, moving us to a place to renew our heart, that we might cleanse ourselves before him. But you know what the thing is that every ignoble vessel, when he raises it up, he is also the first one to wipe it out. That's why those kingdoms did not continue to stand. God uses everyone, either for noble purposes or for ignoble purposes. Your circumstances, your background, your history, your rank in society, your heritage, your gifts, your skills, your looks, your likes, your dislikes. Everything about you is known to God who made you and can use all of those things to his glory. The only question is when he uses those things to his glory, will they also be to your glory? When he uses those things to his glory, when he achieves his victory, will it also be your victory? See, Esther reminds us that even when no one is talking about God, God is at work, and we see the work of God in these things. We even see that in the midst of her hardship, her difficulty, her trials, when she could have been complaining, when she could have said, God, you're not fair. I grew up as an orphan. God, you're not being good to me because I've been in this situation. God, you're not fair to me. You're putting me in the house of my enemy and the very people who brought this devastation on me. God, how could you be so unkind? How could you be so cruel? Or maybe in the midst of even our hardships, our difficulties, our trials, the things we don't understand, God is using us to change the outcome of the world. Or maybe just the life of a little child who's dying in anguish, and its last memory of earth will be sweet because you were a noble vessel. See, we want to be rock stars. Some of us would gladly change places with Queen Esther, but before you are quick to want to change places with Esther, do you know how she got there? Do you know the situation under which she is suffering as she serves? Do you know that the man that she lays in bed with is the one that his father was responsible for the death of her parents? And she has to please him? Life isn't fair. No, it's not. No, it's not. But the question is, do you trust God even in the circumstances you don't understand? Even in the midst of things that make no sense at the time, and some things will become obvious like it did for Esther in her lifetime, but it might be that you might be in the situation where Ruth was, and she would go on to her grave and just a very simple life and have no idea how she impacted the entire world through her humble obedience, through her trust, through her believing that God was good even when her circumstances weren't. See, the question isn't whether or not you will be used. The question is whether you will be used as a noble vessel or an ignoble vessel. Which will you choose?
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. And if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.